This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. After Hannah Gatsby's breakout comedy special called Nanette premiered on Netflix in 2018, it won a Peabody Award, an Emmy Award, and was described in the New York Times as, quote, the most talked about, written about, shared about comedy act in years, unquote. What made the show especially provocative was her vow to give up comedy because she thought the requirements of jokes, setup, punchline, tension, release, were inadequate for describing her life and the anger she felt about how she was abused growing up, gay and closeted in Tasmania, which she describes as the Bible Belt of Australia. Gatsby illustrated her point about comedy by telling a funny story about a guy who thought she was a man hitting on this guy's girlfriend. Later in the set, she retold the story as it really happened. When this guy realized Gatsby was a woman and correctly assumed that she was a lesbian, he beat her badly, and no one stopped him. Here's Gatsby from Nanette.
But this is why I must quit comedy, because the only way I can tell my truth and put tension in the room is with anger. And I am angry, and I believe I've got every right to be angry. But what I don't have a right to do is to spread anger. I don't. Because anger, much like laughter, can connect a room full of strangers like nothing else. But anger, even if it's connected to laughter, will not relieve tension, because anger is a tension. It is a toxic, infectious tension. And it knows no other purpose than to spread blind hatred. And I want no part of it, because I take my freedom of speech as a responsibility. And just because I can position myself as a victim does not make my anger constructive. It never is constructive. Laughter is not our medicine. Stories hold our cure. Laughter is just the honey that sweetens the bitter medicine. I don't want to unite you with laughter or anger. I just needed my story heard, my story felt and understood by individuals with minds of their own.
Gatsby did take a break from performing after touring with that show, but she hasn't given up comedy. And now she's back with a new comedy special called Douglas, named after the first dog she had as an adult. It just started streaming on Netflix. Here's an excerpt from early in the show.
If you're here because of Nanette, why? Like, don't get me wrong, it's a good show, solid bit of work. I'm quite fond, but it was a particular show of a very particular flavour. And if that is what is bought, what the f*** are you expecting from this show? Because I'm sorry, if it's more trauma, I'm fresh out. Had I known just how wildly popular trauma was going to be in the context of comedy, I might have budgeted my shit a bit better. Honestly, I could have built quite the career out of it, at least a trilogy, but I went and put all my trauma eggs into one basket like a f***ing idiot, and now here we are.
Hannah Gatsby, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You are welcome. It's a pleasure to have you. So, you know, I guess you didn't give up comedy. I'm glad you did not. Were you surprised by the impact that had at the end of Nanette when so many comics in America started wondering, like, should I rethink comedy? Does comedy have limitations I haven't thought of? Were you surprised by all of that?
Look, I was surprised by the positive response all the way through performing it. Like, the first time I performed it, you know, I knew that I was putting something kind of electric out into the audience, and it sort of built and built and built, and I was just blown away by how positive the response was overall, like, you know, the impact of it. And, you know, I didn't think it would be so successful. I just thought, you know what, I have to say these things, and I'm willing to sacrifice my career for that. I can move on. So I am surprised that it was so positive, but because it was so positive, it seems only natural that other comedians are going, well, perhaps I should rethink. And I think that's healthy. You know, I'm not saying that everyone should change the way they do things, but I think a bit of a shake-up is good.
So you do not dwell on trauma in your new Netflix special, but you did talk about how in 2017 you were diagnosed with having autism spectrum disorder, and another hilarious subject.
That was in 2016.
2016, thank you. But you were very positive about it. You say, you know, that might sound like it was horrible to get the diagnosis, but it actually gave you a new way of understanding yourself. What are some of the things that made you feel really different that started to make sense after you got the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder?
I found out and things started to make sense because it shifted the way that I understood myself. I was always operating on the false premise that everyone saw the world like I did. So I was just getting it wrong. I was getting a lot of things wrong. And the most difficult was my interpersonal sort of life. Because, you know, on stage, in interviews, g'day, the boundaries and the rules of engagement are very clear. But once you step out of these things and, you know, you're talking to people, you're building relationships with people, there's so much more uncertainty, and I don't read the room nearly as well. So in many ways, I appear very good at being social, but it's an incredibly exhausting process for me. So when I was diagnosed, it just gave me permission to be kinder to myself, to not always take responsibility for being, you know, a bit clumsy around other people, and allowed me to sort of start to tell people, you know, I'm clumsy, but I don't mean to be, and being more open about, I need you to tell me what I did wrong. And then we can move on from there. Whereas, I would just get in a lot of trouble from my friends and whatnot for being insensitive. And, you know, and it was kind of a double bind because I'm very sensitive and I'm very thoughtful, but I miss things that other people sort of go, well, that's, you should just know that.
Like what?
Do you know, I'm very blunt and I'm very honest. So there's that, there is this sort of, it's almost a hack joke where, you know, and it's the irony is the gendered of it, where a woman will say to a man, does my bum look big in this? And the man will go, yes. You know, it's an old joke. And then, and I've done that. not the bum thing, because, you know, I probably have a larger bum, so I never think anyone's bum is big. But, you know, I remember an ex-girlfriend asked me if I liked her new haircut, and I absolutely didn't. And I can't lie, so I said I'm not fond. And that was a week-long recovery mission. And that was before I was diagnosed. And it wasn't even a bad haircut. It just was wrong for her face. And I studied art history, and I was going on it from a, you know, that point of view. And, I have bad hair, so I really had no place. And I can undo it in hindsight, but hindsight is not a great gift in the moment.
Let's talk about growing up in Tasmania. So homosexuality was illegal until 1997. How old were you when that law was overturned?
I have to do the math. I was born in 78. What does that make? 17? No, 19. Gosh. 19.
Okay. Was that law actually enforced? Like, were people fined or put in jail if they were gay? If they were caught, like, in a gay bar or something? I guess there weren't gay bars in Tasmania.
Not really. Like, the action of the, like, it became a thing when people tried to change the law. I think before that, it was basically, don't tell anyone, then it's fine. But it also meant it was permission for violence.
I was wondering that, because you were, you know, you were beaten, you were raped, you were sexually abused, and I was wondering if the men who did that to you felt entitled to harm you because your sexuality made you a criminal and your religion made you a sinner.
No, well, it wasn't my religion, and I think that's more to do with misogyny than, like, anything else. Like, I think that's just, you know, men having ownership over women's bodies more than anything. The being beaten, you know, certainly was, because that was at the height of the debate. So the debate was being pushed into the media, and, you know, the media tends to amplify the most extreme voices. And so what people don't see is the ramification of that on the ground. And I saw it firsthand.
So you think the debate was empowering people to be violent?
Absolutely.
To be cruel?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you think that if neighbors knew that you were a lesbian, that they might have, like, turned you in to the police or something?
No.
Like, did it ever get to that point where people thought, like, this is illegal and I have to take action against it?
Well, first of all, the law pertained to sodomy, so being a lesbian was just a complete invisibility. Like, we don't even exist.
Yes, right.
But you couldn't be out and proud by any stretch. But no, the generally it was about, you know, gay men.
And did you have friends who were gay men who were more...
No, I didn't have any friends.
Do you mean that literally?
Yeah. I mean, I had neighbors. My best friends when I was growing up were my elderly next door neighbors. And I used to go over to their house every day after school and have a cup of tea and a biscuit and a bit of quiet time, because I was the youngest of quite a large family and it was very loud. And school was a lot for me. And so I'd just go over and we'd just sit and have a quiet chat and a nap and get a bit of quiet. And they were my best friends. But, you know, they were sort of in the brethren branch of religion. So it was all fire and brimstone. So there was always this, you know, the older I got, this sort of anxiety about that. So it was never on the surface, but there was this increasing anxiety. You know, I adored this couple and they meant the world to me. But as I got older, it was like, I can't share that. So you begin to cleave off these large parts of your emotional landscape and reality from the people you spend the most time with. And that's the real painful thing.
Yeah, because it was probably like, not only can I share this, but if they only knew, they might not be so nice to me.
Yeah, and you can't share it in that vulnerable time when you're like, I'm trying to work something out about myself. And, you know, so you're left on your own at a time in your life when really you need to be guided by adults.
You were homeless for a while. What period of your life was that, and why were you homeless?
Once I finished my degree, it was a 3-year degree that took me 5 years, I didn't know what to do then. Once I left the beats that you're supposed to hit, you know, and then they're like, okay, you're off into the world. I was unable to navigate that. You know, I struggled to fill in forms. I've never been able to apply for a job in the traditional form. I've always just picked up sort of casual entry-level work. And, you know, the older you get, the less easy that is. You know, when you pop your resume into a place and they're like, why are you so old and have done so little? So I sort of began to drift really badly. You know, I worked in a bookshop for a little while and then I was a cinema projectionist and then I travelled up to the north of Australia. I was going to work at an outdoor cinema because I, you know, I had an actual skill that is no longer an actual skill, but at the time. And from there, I found I couldn't actually hold down a job. I was unable to, you know, earn enough money and also navigate just the basic administration of life. I look back on that time, I feel quite sad. It's like I didn't understand that I genuinely needed help. I needed assistance.
Do you attribute that to autism?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became a farm laborer and I lived in a tent, basically no fixed address for a couple of years.
Were you sleeping on the street at all?
Well, no, because I was in the in the country, so there's no need to be on the street. I had a tent. And, you know, and then I'd drift in and, you know, work on farms and then... But I had no safety net. I had no backup. And, I mean, I certainly slept rough, but it was just not on a street. I'm taking that really literally.
Right.
Did you sleep on the streets? And I'm like, yeah, yes, I guess. But basically, I just...
There weren't a lot of streets, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I walked out of town and found a nice spot and pitched a tent. And
So you had no safety net. Did you have any safety sleeping like that?
No, I guess not, no. No capacity.
Were you ever, you know, like robbed or attacked while you were homeless?
Not... I guess I was, but not, you know... because someone broke into my tent. It's, at one stage I sort of drifted into this sort of communal living situation that turned bad.
That turned bad?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened?
It's where I was raped.
Oh. That's turning really bad.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
Yeah. Did you leave that community afterwards, that living situation?
No, I had nowhere to go.
Well, that's so awful that you had to stay.
Well, that's the reality of no choice, isn't it?
What future did you see for yourself then when you were living in a tent and you had no steady job? You didn't think you could hold one?
I didn't see a future at all. And that's trauma. You're absolutely incapable of imagining a future, incapable of understanding what a dream is.
But you know, you're obviously like very smart and very perceptive and very articulate. Could you comprehend why somebody who was as smart as you were and as knowledgeable, art history degree, would feel like you had so little future in front of you, so few options, so few opportunities?
Yeah, that was always very confusing to me. I didn't understand how I got it all so wrong. I do, you know, this is part of the autism situation. But until I was diagnosed, I could never look back on that part of my life and make complete sense of it. I still struggle, and that is also an effect of trauma. There's no straight line through trauma.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you when you were diagnosed?
I'm terrible at the math situation. 36, I'm 36.
That's a long time not to understand what was going on, you know, neurologically for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
What made you think that you could perform comedy? Did people say that you were funny? Did you think of yourself as funny?
I knew how to be funny. I knew how to tell a story. And the way I'd learned to tell a story was I'd really built this skill to evade the reality of my life and just tell a funny story about a moment. You know, so here's a funny thing that happened. And then I didn't have to tell people about the actual reality of my life. And essentially I entered a comedy competition, and it was on a whim. It wasn't this sort of thing, you know, I'd been hoping to do. I did a lot of things on whim, like, oh, I'll try this thing, I'll try that thing. And there was no reason to expect comedy was going to end any better or worse than all the other failed attempts at my grasp at life. And this is a national competition that was held by the Melbourne Comedy Festival, Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And they run heats all around Australia. They go into regional towns and, you know, hold these competitions. It's actually a really wonderful program because it doesn't dwell on just the cities. And so then, you know, as soon as I sort of told my first, you know, joke, which isn't technically a joke. It was just a few words I strung together. I think it was the combination of, you know, just me being this completely strange creature up on stage that just really made people engage with me. And I held the audience in my hand. I didn't know what to do with them, but I knew that I had them in my hand. So it was clear from the very first time I stood on stage. Now, I'd never held a microphone before. I'd never been a performer. I'd never even been to a comedy show. But all of a sudden, wow. I kind of knew what I was doing.
So what was it like when you were first on stage and realized that you had the power to make people laugh or to make them think or feel moved by what you were saying, that you could get the response that you wanted to get?
It felt like I was connected to the world for the first time. I'd always felt like there was a disconnect between me and the rest of the world. Like, and this is kind of a common experience for people on the spectrum. You sort of feel like an alien being dropped in from outer space and you can't quite connect properly. And being on stage and making a room full of people, you know, laugh felt like a connection I hadn't been able to establish in any other environment.
Considering everything we've talked about, you must be really surprised by your success. You really had so many years of failure and trauma. Honestly, it's kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, you know, I do feel like sometimes when you hear a successful person sort of going, oh, this is a surprise, you're like, yeah, but you worked your whole life toward this, so there's something. You know, like Taylor Swift, I'm not convinced that she's surprised. it's like, but I am genuinely, like, I can't actually process it. I've just bought my first home. Like, I own a home. And for someone who's been homeless, I can't believe it.
It's been great to talk with you, Hannah. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Hannah Gadsby's new comedy special, Douglas, is now streaming on Netflix. She spoke to us from her home in Australia. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of a recent novel that she says, through the vehicle of comic fiction, takes readers on a road trip through struggling towns and farmlands of rural America. It's called St. Christopher on Pluto. It's by Nancy McKinley.
I'm feeling so cooped up these days, who isn't, that I sometimes find myself getting in the car and taking aimless rides to nowhere. Maybe that's what prompted me to finally check out an on-the-road novel that came out in February, right before the pandemic brought life as we know it to a hard stop. Nancy McKinley's novel, constructed out of a series of interlocking stories, is called St. Christopher on Pluto. Note that odd title. It summons up, first, a Catholic saint who was demoted because of questions about his historical veracity, and Pluto, once a planet, but now demoted to a dwarf planet. Demoted or diminished is how you might think of the northeastern Pennsylvania setting of this novel. Once the area around Wilkes-Barre boasted industry, family farms, and coal mines, but in recent times, the region has been scarred by unemployment and the opioid epidemic. In McKinley's novel, two hometown gals ride around this terrain in a vintage Buick nicknamed Big Blue. Mary Catherine, MK for short, is a quiet woman who inherited the Buick from her grandmother. Colleen is the madcap troublemaker. In the opening story here, Colleen cons MK into helping her commit insurance fraud by ditching her own Honda hatchback clunker in a remote ravine. St. Christopher on Pluto drew me in by its humor. But like the best comic fiction, it's constructed out of insider social observations, observations that sting as much as they amuse. We learn early on that MK and Colleen first met in the 1960s when they were students at Our Lady of Perpetual Help Elementary School. They'd lost touch, but ran into each other again in late midlife, both working at the local mall. Colleen has a job at the Hallmark store. MK works as a manager at Walden Books, which, over the course of this novel, is bought out by Borders, which is, in turn, bought out by Books A Million, until the entire wheezing mall itself is bought out by foreign investors who plan to gut the space for a fracking truck depot. Bossy Colleen prides herself on being a do-gooder, always ready to push MK and Big Blue into volunteer work, which takes the two white women and this novel on road trips deep into the less traveled corners of Northeast Pennsylvania. Some stories here grow out of the casual relationships the women form through their jobs at the mall. For instance, a teenager named Tiffany, who works at the food court, stars in the poignant penultimate story, where she runs with MK and Colleen in a Thanksgiving turkey trot charity race. She's psyched because she's got a lead on a waitressing job at the Jersey Shore. And then, approaching the finish line, she trips, and you get the sense that she's never going to make it. Other stories take notice of old-timers, like the Pumpers, a group of senior citizens who've survived heart attacks and power walk at the mall. They've been left behind as their kids moved away. It's the newer residents of the Wilkes-Barre area, however, who inspire McKinley's most unexpected weddings of screwball humor to social criticism. In a standout story called Navidad, the two friends volunteer at a church Christmas party. Here's MK describing the harebrained beginning of this particular car ride. Colleen yanks open the passenger door of Big Blue. She wears a red sweater matched by a voluminous skirt that cascades over her knees. "Ho, ho, you like?" she asks. Her fingers tug at silver garland, edging the hem. "My skirt was half price at Salvo." I smile, knowing how Colleen takes pride in snagging deals at the Salvation Army thrift store. "It's handmade, but the seams aren't finished. No clasp at the waist, so I use duct tape." And that's when I realize she's wearing one of those round felt covers people put under Christmas trees. I decide not to say anything. The tone shifts when the women arrive at the church, where the kids, all Latinx, are jammed into the church hall. Because of the sometimes violent local resentment against the newcomers, the church is keeping quiet about this party. As MK tells us, there will be no human interest clips on the local news. Leave it to Colleen to involve me in a covert Christmas party. Covert is a good way to characterize how this droll novel in stories delivers its social commentary. It's so entertaining to go along for the ride with MK and chatty Colleen. And because of their wry, sometimes bumbling, suck-it-up resiliency, it's also possible to take in these hard luck landscapes and see some possibility amidst all the losses.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the novel St. Christopher on Pluto by Nancy McKinley. 6 years ago, the American intelligence community was rocked by the leak of thousands of classified documents on U.S. surveillance programs by National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. Our guest, Barton Gellman, was one of three journalists Snowden chose to provide the documents to. Gellman's new book is about the experience of reporting on the massive archive and about the meaning of the Snowden revelations in the debate over national security and privacy. Gellman says he believes Snowden did more good than harm, but their relationship wasn't simple or easy. At times, Snowden stopped communicating with Gellman. Gellman's book is a gripping account of high-stakes investigative reporting, and in it he reveals new information about U.S. surveillance of American citizens. Barton Gellman has covered national security and intelligence issues for decades. He spent 21 years at the Washington Post, where he earned three Pulitzer Prizes, one of them for quarterbacking the team that worked on the Snowden revelations. Gelman is currently a staff writer for The Atlantic. His new book is called Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Barton Gelman, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, pleasure to be here, Dave.
You were one of three journalists that he provided this material, and really the only one with a background as a mainstream journalist. How did Snowden regard you as opposed to the other? Laura Poitras, the documentary filmmaker, and Glenn Greenwald, then with The Guardian.
Snowden chose Glenn Greenwald first because he was a commentator, an opinion leader, someone who was a powerful voice of skepticism against the establishment. And Snowden wanted that sort of loud and clear and all-in kind of defense. He chose Laura Poitras because she was a filmmaker who had herself been subject to the scrutiny of the surveillance state after she made a film about Iraq. She found herself stopped every time she crossed a border into the United States and had her belongings searched, her videotape copied, her files copied, and so on. Snowden came late to me. Laura Poitras convinced him that having a mainstream journalist along and having someone who knew the subject, as I did, would be good for him. Snowden was deeply skeptical. He thought that the Washington Post would be afraid to publish or would bow down to government pressure. I had many conversations with him before he agreed to include me, in which I said, "You don't understand my world at all. We don't stand down because the government doesn't want to see a story." It took a lot of convincing for him, just as it took a lot of convincing for me that he was for real.
And just review for us what the terms were of him providing this information to you and the other two reporters.
Well, I told Snowden that I was not undertaking in advance to publish everything he gave me, or anything in particular, that I would make my own judgment about the news value, and that I would give the government an opportunity to tell me about damage they foresaw if the story was published. And so I had that conversation with the government every time. Snowden, at first, seemed a little skeptical about this and worried that it simply meant I was going to give the government veto power over an article. And in fact, he saw it as potential evidence of a cowardly approach by the Washington Post. Later, he came to see the value and the importance of trying to avoid avoidable harm in the publication of these stories, and he began to insist that that was what he wanted all along.
Snowden has always said publicly that he wanted the journalists to evaluate this material and handle it responsibly. He didn't want to dump it on the internet or give it to WikiLeaks, but he wanted journalists to make judgments. And I think he says he wanted them to confer with the government so harm could be avoided. Was that your understanding all along?
Snowden absolutely wanted us to make our own judgments about newsworthiness. He absolutely did not want us to dump the entire archive online. If he wanted that, he could have done it himself. I mean, the guy knows how to work the internet. He wanted the credibility of journalists behind the disclosures. He wanted us to check the facts and set the context, and he wanted us to decide what was newsworthy and what was harmful. So he essentially relinquished all the close judgment calls to me and my fellow journalists.
And eventually, he left himself without even access to all this material, right?
That's right. That's one of the most fascinating things here. Once he gave the documents to me and the other two, he removed his own ability to access them. He destroyed the encryption key. And he did that because he didn't want to lose the documents, he didn't want them to be stolen, and he didn't want to be compelled to open them when he crossed a border. He foresaw that he would be under the authority of one or another foreign government. He didn't want to be carrying around a suitcase that he could open that would expose all those U.S. secrets directly to a foreign government. So he made it literally impossible for him to do so.
I want to talk a bit about your relationship with Snowden. He said at one point, I think, that he vetted you more than anybody else among the three journalists, and that in the end you screwed him. What did he mean?
Snowden wanted advocates on his side. He wanted a pure and clear message of dissent against the way the NSA was behaving, and he wanted nothing that would raise any doubts or questions about him or get into his personal life or anything like that. I continued to ask questions the way a journalist should ask questions. And so we would have these tense exchanges in which he would say, for example, "Are you purposely asking me things you know I won't answer just to piss me off?" He was angry at me the first time he got angry at me, he was right to be angry. In an early profile of him, I inadvertently exposed an online handle, an anonymous handle that he was still using for communications. And that caused him some trouble as he tried to change handles and encryption keys on the fly.
Right. And that's when he quit talking to you for a while, right?
He quit talking to me for several months after that. We started up again because he believed I was handling these stories seriously, that I was diving into the subject in a way that was exposing truths that weren't being exposed anywhere else. Because this wasn't just a question of opening the documents, reading, and writing your story. The documents were incomplete pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, very hard to understand. They required external reporting with sources in the government and out of the government. They required interpretation and discovery. And I was putting things together in a way that he thought was important. And so he got over his personal anger at the way I behaved.
Right. I think it was December of 2013 you went over to visit him in Moscow, right? I don't know how much you can talk about this, but I'm curious about your security precautions in making that trip. I mean, you were careful. You're careful to protect your digital data. Did you figure that the Russians would be following you or surveilling you while you were there?
You know, I don't like to be dramatic or self-important, but I thought, yeah, there's a pretty good chance that if an American journalist who's writing about secret American intelligence programs comes over to interview a former intelligence officer named Ed Snowden, that would probably be worth their devotion of a little bit of surveillance themselves. I assumed that my devices and my telephone calls would be monitored. And so to begin with, I didn't bring any data over with me. I wasn't going to bring classified U.S. documents to a country where they could possibly read them and directly expose American secrets to a foreign power. And I didn't log on to any of my accounts. I didn't bring my actual computer or my usual telephone. I brought empty ones. But I still had the puzzle of how I was going to interview Snowden, take notes, take photographs, make recordings, and then bring those back to the United States while crossing an international border and not hand over those documents, those recordings, and so on to either government. I didn't want the U.S. government to hear everything I had said with Snowden. I didn't want the Russian government to have access to all that information either.
So how did you get the material safely back without carrying it over the border?
So there are one or two tricks that I won't mention, but here's something I can. I tape recorded the interviews with Snowden on a digital recorder that recorded the audio onto a little memory card, an SD card. And so what I did was, as soon as the interview ended, I would copy the data from the SD card, which was unencrypted, into an encrypted archive on my computer. And it was encrypted with a key that I didn't carry with me. It is possible, using something called GPG, to encrypt a file in a way that you yourself cannot decrypt it until you go pick up the key that you've left back in New York, for example. So I encrypted it that way. I uploaded it onto some cloud servers in that encrypted form. And I also did not carry the key that enabled me to download from those same servers. And then I took the SD card out of my computer and I cut it into pieces. So I was no longer to be in possession of the audio file at all. It was sitting in the cloud waiting for me, and I just hoped to God that I didn't screw it up and that I could decrypt it when I got home.
You spent a lot of time talking with him. Did you end up with a different impression of him than you had before?
I did. I was expecting to find a guy who was very serious, and I did find that. I was expecting to find a guy in Moscow who was shell-shocked and lonely and very conscious of the sacrifices that he'd made and maybe even having second thoughts. It's one thing to anticipate that you're going to be alone in a foreign country, but he had not actually even planned to be in Russia. He got stuck there. And what I found instead was a guy who was very much at peace with his choices, who is, as he described himself, an indoor cat who doesn't usually go out into the world very much anyway. His socializing and his intellectual and his productive work is almost all done online. I asked him at one point, how many hours a day do you think you're online? And he said, the hours that I'm awake.
There was a House Intelligence Committee report about Snowden, which was harshly critical. And there's been reporting that the classified version of that report listed several instances in which national security was harmed. I'm wondering if you have any insight into what those instances were.
If there were particular harms done by particular disclosures, that fact itself would be classified, as you mentioned. And so I can't argue with an assertion that's made in the dark. And there may be legitimate reasons to keep that classified. On the other hand, I would have to say that, not to put a fine point on it, that House Intelligence Committee report was garbage. It was a political document. It was basically a long screed about Ed Snowden, and it was filled with facts or assertions of fact that were plainly rebuttable, that were simply wrong. Just the simple question of calling Ed Snowden a high school dropout. He had earned his GED at the same time that his class graduated with top scores. They knew that he had advanced computer security and computer science credentials. Or, for example, they said there's no evidence that Ed Snowden actually was injured in the army, and so he was lying about the reasons for the end to his army service. Well, army records made it very clear. I've seen the records. He broke both legs in training. And for the House Intelligence Committee, which had privileged access to government records, to say things like that gives you a decent flavor of the more complicated untruths in the report.
It's interesting the effect breaking this story had on your life. Apart from dealing with the government and dealing with Snowden, you are now publicly in possession of a lot of secrets, and you're pretty careful about, protecting your digital information. But did you become aware that you were either being followed or surveilled or people were trying to hack your stuff?
Yeah, it's not paranoid if people are really trying to get you. And I knew from the first time I saw the documents before I published a story that this was going to paint a big target on my back. It's advertising that you have something special and secret, and advertising pretty quickly that I was not going to publish all of it. So I knew that I would be a subject of interest to hackers, to the U.S. government, and to foreign intelligence agencies. And I gradually accumulated considerable evidence that this was true. Someone tried to break into my Gmail accounts where I did not store sensitive documents. But nevertheless, Google warned me. A big flashing pink bar on my screen said, warning, we believe that state-sponsored attackers are trying to break into your device or your account. I found out later that that was the government of Turkey. Turkey was unexpected and bad news for me because I thought there were a substantial number of likelier candidates and more capable candidates coming after me. So if Turkey also was joining the party, that suggested the threat landscape was broader than I would have liked to think. My iPad was hacked right in front of my eyes as I was holding it. The screen guttered out into static, and then white letters started marching across the screen with technical commands in a language called Unix. If that had worked as expected, as intended, it would have happened while I slept or wasn't looking at the machine. And after a couple of minutes of fooling around like that, the hacker would have complete control of the device. And what worried me about that was that remotely hacking an iPad is not a beginner's hack. It's quite difficult and quite expensive. To break through Apple's considerable security remotely without physically connecting to the device is a $1 million hack. That is to say that that data brokers surveillance brokers pay $1 million bounties for what's called an untethered hack of the iPad operating system. And I did not want to be worth that kind of effort. I did not want to be worth that kind of expense, but I was.
Will Barton Gellman, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you for allowing me. I love this show.
Barton Gellman spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Gellman is a staff writer at The Atlantic. His new book is called Dark Mirror: Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State.